Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Can you just describe what you're doing now?
So right now, I'm going to get ready to brew up a Jebbina.
And what's a Jebbina?
So the Jebbina is the Ethiopian coffee pot.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wing, and you're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. And this is Solomon Dubé. He's the 29-year-old founder of Café Avol, a cozy little coffee shop in Rainier Valley. It's one of the only places in Seattle where you can get Ethiopian coffee brewed the traditional way in what's called a Jebbina. It's a clay pot with a long neck and a short spout.
When I first bought my first Jebbina, my aunt would examine the Jebbina. She'd put her ear against the straw and she'd knock on the bottom of the pot and just to hear it, to see if there's enough airflow going in it. But it's very interesting.
So they're all handmade?
They're all handmade.
Solomon was born and raised in Seattle, but his family is from Ethiopia, where the coffee plant was first discovered. And they take coffee seriously, but it's not just about the taste. It's a whole event.
The thing that I like about it, about the Jebbina, is the social aspect. So typically, like, my mom would invite her friends over and they'll sit there for about 2 to 3 hours, maybe an hour, you know, just hanging out and just drinking and just sharing coffee. And you'd go through 3 rounds of the Jebbina. The first round is called Avol. And that just signifies, like, it's like just the richest, the first round, and everybody knows, like, hey, you know, this is the first round. But what will happen is they'll add water, rebrew the pot, and you would get a huletenga, which means second. And that's the second round that we'll go to. And then once we're done with that pot, we'll do the third round, which is butaka. And when you get to butaka, it's like that signification, like, okay, we're done. We'll say our final farewells.
It's so much more involved than going to a coffee shop right now where you could text your order ahead of time.
Right. It's not something that's like you're just your quick in and out, let me go live my life. It's more so like, well, what's going on in your life? What's the latest topic that we could talk about today? One thing I noticed in Ethiopia was how I was really at peace when it came down to just the social aspect of life. I mean, you know, people worked, people get their things done, but they found a way to really just be at peace and just chill. I'd wake up in the morning, my aunt would cook breakfast and would be at the house, and shortly after, it's time for the Jebbina time now. And here we go again.
Do you see this coffee shop creating that setting here?
Yeah, it's sort of building that culture of sitting down and sharing coffee together. And in Ethiopian culture, when we eat injera, it's one huge platter for everyone to eat with. And the same thing with the Jebbina, it's one coffee pot for everybody to drink out of. They say that when two people eat for one plate, they argue less.
Food is so much more than flavor and texture. It's about the people we share it with. It's about the people who make the food we eat. Where we eat also affects how much we feel about a particular food. I will forever associate lima beans with my Aunt Josephine's kitchen table and her dog, Gretchen, who would patiently wait under the table to eat those buttered beans I so detested. Today on Sound Effect, we are hungry. Just ahead, we'll talk to a chef about why she loves cooking for other people. We'll visit an unusual coffee shop that is very different from Solomon's Cafe in Seattle. And did you know that there is a type of hot dog that you can only get in the Northwest? I had no idea. We'll tell you all about it just ahead.
This is going to be your seat, sir. Feel free to sit down and start eating. And who is behind him?
I'm Ed.
Ed, nice to meet you. I'm Rick. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I'm going to sit to you right here.
One of the many pleasures in life is catching up with a friend while you both share a good meal cooked by someone else. This is what you're hearing right now. Two of our friends from the KNKX newsroom, Ed Ronco and Ariel Van Cleave, getting seated at a cafe for dinner.
Oh, my goodness.
But here's the thing.
I can see nothing right now. It is the darkest room I've ever been in.
This is not your typical restaurant. It's a traveling event called the Blind Cafe. People eat dinner in the pitch black. They can't see their knives, their forks, the people seated next to them. They can't see their food. The organizers of this, they say it's not about simulating what it's actually like to live with blindness. But they do want people who share a meal in this way, in the complete dark, to perceive the world around them a little differently. 88.5's Ed Ronco picks it up from here.
Okay, let's back up. It is about 8 p.m., still daylight, and about a dozen of us are waiting to get into the Blind Cafe, which is housed inside a big brick building called Nalanda West, kind of an events center in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood. We don't really know what to expect. Dinner in the dark, a talk about blindness, a little live music. Outside, we meet Brandon Langdon.
I block the room out. I'm the master of darkness and I'm all of that stuff. So if you want to ask any questions, you can ask me.
They told me you'll be needing to tape up some of my gear a little bit.
What I do is I just have you sit in a chair and then I drape the fabric over you and I duct tape you.
That's perfect. Actually, it kind of gets swaddled in dark fabric and duct tape, so the glowing screen and all the little indicator lights are not visible. Now, before we go in, we have to prove that our cell phones are off, not airplane mode, not vibrate, off. And we have to prove it, show the phone to somebody. Watches go in the pocket, and Ariel and I are matched up with three other people to make a table of five. There's Jennifer.
I study plant physiology.
She's a grad student at the University of Washington. And next to her...
I'm Rio. I'm also a grad student at University of Washington.
And then a young guy named Idris.
Yeah, I'm a student. I'm from the UK. I did an exchange, and like now I'm basically just a tourist.
But that's it. That's all we know. We don't know what the room looks like, or where we'll be sitting, or what we'll be eating. We're told to stand in a line and put one hand on the shoulder of the person in front of us, and at the head of the line is a guy named Rick. He's blind and the keynote speaker tonight.
Oh, you guys good?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right.
I think so.
He leads us to our table through what feels like a winding fabric tunnel.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
We're going to be making a right turn.
Wow. It's so dark.
I know.
Like, I knew it was going to be dark, but this is dark.
This is so dark.
Oh, sorry. Beg your pardon. Could be a lot of that tonight.
I think there's going to be a moratorium on beg your pardon.
Oh, my gosh.
All right.
I took a piece of bread.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
and
so
you've just
that.
Pushed it to me here.
Pushed it to you there. I'm not even...
And I just put my finger in the butter. Sorry, everybody.
This is awesome.
I was trying really hard not to.
I'm curious how far, like, how big this table is.
I know, because you have an end, right?
Yeah.
Because we're right across from each other.
Yeah. I'm going to stick my hand out.
Can you direct me to the end of your table?
Okay, right. So the end of the table is right here.
Okay, it's my arm's distance away. So,
okay. That's a lot of effort. Why not just pass out blindfolds and say, all right, everybody, come on in?
If we gave everybody blindfolds, they would have control. And the whole magic of the Blind Cafe is that you have to relinquish control.
Brian Rochelot started the Blind Cafe in 2010. Everyone just calls him Rosh.
When you come here, if you go to a regular restaurant, you are kind of isolated and you get your own individual tables. But here, we have you all sit at large tables together in the dark and you have to break bread together. And it creates community and it breaks down social barriers. And we have no light, but we also have this Tibetan singing bowl that we ring. In the dark, that brings everybody together.
Nice.
So guys, my name is Rick Hammonds, and we're going to open up to questions and answers pretty soon. But before we do that, I thought it might be a good idea for you to get to know the person you're going to be asking questions to. I was born blind with an underdeveloped optic nerve. I wasn't a premature baby, but for some reason my optic nerve just didn't develop correctly in the womb.
I have been involved with the Blind Cafe since it started in February of 2010. I've learned that it's good to lose control, right? Because you never really have full control, so it's good to like give up that illusion of control for a little while. It's scary, but it's a lot of fun.
Ariel with a question.
Ariel, go ahead.
I just raised my hand. What's it like when you interact with someone who can see and they realize that you can't?
So I'm in high school and I want to go to this job interview. A friend of mine told me about this job selling something over the phone. go down there, waiting in the office, and when I called to make the plans, they said that we're really, really excited, we don't have enough people here. Guy comes out, I go in the room. Back then I used what's called like a foldable cane, right? So he didn't see that, you know, I was blind, and then he gives me something to read. I pull out like a little like thing to read it, and I have to get really, really close up, and he's like, are you blind? And I'm like, yeah. And then the whole tone of the interview changed from, we really need help, to, well, I really don't know if we can use you at this time. Might be kind of difficult for you. But I was younger, and I didn't really have the experience to know that that's not the way that everybody's going to react.
So this is Raj speaking. You guys up for some music? I think we're going to move into the music thing. Yeah. Any guitar players in the house?
Sure.
Sure. You're like, sure, I could be a guitar player if you want. I'll participate.
You know, we always have 1 to 3 people each weekend that they go into the darkness and it's just too much. But if they stick it through, that first 10 to 20 minutes of the Blind Cafe is the most challenging. But once you get past that, it's like smooth sailing. You don't have your phone, you don't have to worry about being seen by other people, and you don't have, it's an interesting new experience. We were in Portland a few weeks ago, and this woman started sharing in the dark, and she started crying, and she started saying that, like, she says, I feel so free because I feel like for the first time in a social situation, I don't feel like I'm being judged for being black or for being overweight. And she just starts spilling her beans about, like, how I'm usually seen as a black woman first, and it's a powerful experience to be in the dark and actually be judged and related to for who I am and not for my color.
It's time to put your clothes on if you're naked. You always have to check Seattle and Portland like that one.
All of a sudden, Rosh flicks a lighter and lights a candle.
Wow.
And we can see the room for the first time. It is not that big. It's carpeted, a small stage. We've been sitting at a plastic rectangular table not far from the other two tables.
You know, I thought it was smaller. I thought the room was smaller. I felt like I was in some kind of tent. You know, did you guys feel that? Like,
yeah, I kind of thought that same thing. I was thinking, like, there was actually, like, we were in a tent. Like, we walked into a tent of some kind. Yeah.
Okay, so we are back in the car. It is almost 4 hours after I picked you up for this thing. And we're just leaving. It's 11:20
yeah.
p.m.
And it's been quite an experience.
What did you learn about yourself?
I learned that I am a real anxiety-ridden person. Because I was thinking about how I was feeling while we were walking in there, and I was nervous. But then once we got in and we sat down, I wasn't. And I didn't think about anything else except for the fact that I was enjoying the conversation, I was enjoying the food, I was enjoying the company, enjoying what I was hearing, enjoying hearing from a blind person mm-hmm. about their experience, and it just all washed away.
I learned that I am not as good a listener as I think I am. I did notice afterward, you know, we were interviewing Rosh, who's the organizer of it. I was distracted. I felt almost like I was being rude to Rosh because I wasn't as focused on him as I was when I was in the room in the pitch blackness.
Interesting.
So
you're going to be less distracted and I'm going to calm down.
This is going to work out for us both.
That story comes from Ed Ronco with help from Ariel Van Cleve. You're tuned to Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today on the show, we are hungry. Christy Brown moved to Seattle from Kansas City as a teen in the 80s, and here she fell in love with the Northwest culinary scene, its diversity and the variety that's on display at any of the area's farmers markets where you can find one-of-a-kind apples, the color of a pink sunset inside, locally cured meats and peaches from east of the mountains the size of melons. Christy is a chef and caterer. She's worked at a lot of top local Black-run restaurants, including the iconic Kingfish Cafe. It was a high-end soul food restaurant in Capitol Hill. It closed in 2015. Elena Caldwell from the podcast Hella Black, Hella Seattle sat down with Christy in Christy's home in South Seattle and talked about how Christy first decided to be a chef.
My dad and mother were teachers, and they just were really, like, you had to go to college. That it was no exception. That was just the deal. And my oldest brother got into, he was in college, and he was in his senior year and decided that he loved music so much that he wanted to change his major. Well, at the time, he was an accounting major. And so he did it. He changed his major, and my dad was livid because that meant he wasn't going to graduate on time. And I think my dad was just in this space. And so he came back home after talking to him and was like, you know what, go to the library and figure out what you want to do with your life. And I was like, but I'm 13, like I, you know, I'm just a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, so I was super mad. And I stomped down to the library and went up to the library and I was like, I'm supposed to figure out what I'm supposed to do in my future. Where do I go? Mm-hmm. So she took me to the card catalog and we went through and she said, okay, well, what do you like to do? And I said, well, I like to eat, you know, I like to kick it with my friends. I like to cook sometimes. And she was like, oh, so you want to go into hospitality? And I was like, huh? Oh, okay. Yeah. So she was like, what do you watch on TV? And I was like, Hotel. So Hotel was this show with Sherry Belafonte. And it was like the only serious show on TV with a Black woman in it. And so I was super excited. I went to work in hotels. And so I came home and I was like, I want to be a chef. And as an educated Black family, they weren't exactly happy about their daughter wanting to be in the service industry. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think that thankfully for my brothers, mess up that they wanted me to be happy and they wanted me to do something that I was going to commit to doing. Mm-hmm. So I don't think at that point they cared. So that's really how it started, or officially how it started. But I have a menu that I was 5 years old, and I used to write, like, I'm going to make this for the first course and for the second course. So that's my thing to let me know. I mean, first of all, I'm a big believer in working in your purpose. Mm-hmm. That really is the only answer that you have if you want to be happy. Mm-hmm. So I knew that it was just a divine reminder that that's what I was supposed to be doing.
So where did you start at? I heard Kingfish. Is that really where you started?
Yeah. No, I worked at a store. It was called the Corner Store, and it was at the Bond. So before Macy's, that building was built for the Bond Marché. Mm-hmm. My boss was Edwina, and she was just amazing. And I told her that I was coming in for the cashier hostess position, but I was going to go work in the kitchen after that. And she was like, yeah, you don't want to do that. But I kept asking. And so she was like, okay, I'll give you a try. And she did. And I loved it. I got to learn how to make breakfast, which if you're going to learn how to cook just straight out of a restaurant, that's the best time because it's the fastest time. You have to be on your toes and know what you're doing because people don't want over medium eggs if they ask for over easy, you know. So yeah,
so now tell me about Kingfish.
Well,
Kingfish was beautiful, by the way. I just feel like I need to say that
it was an amazing experience to be in a place with, at the time it was the all the three sisters and the chef and I, and
We had the crew, Cherry, our dishwasher. She was good. Like, so it was just like all these powerful Black women doing this amazing thing around presenting our food in a light that didn't downplay it and make it seem like it was, oh, you know, just go around the corner and get you some such and such. It wasn't like that. And it was a really excellent experience. And I feel like, you know, there just wasn't a lot of people doing that. Definitely not in Seattle. I mean, no shade to Miss Helens or any of the people that had come before them. It just was a different level of service. And so it was just an amazing opportunity to do that kind of work with women. You know, and
that
I didn't,
sounds empowering.
Yeah, I didn't really, I think I'm still like understanding the power of that now. Yeah.
That's how it goes sometimes.
For sure. I think that's for everything. You get what you get, the understanding that you can't get at that time. And as you grow, you're like, oh, okay. You know, it's all about perspective.
Yeah. So for the podcast, I do the food reviews. So I'm all about food. So I have to just ask you, around that time, was there like a favorite place to go?
I'm so funny about food. Like my favorite place, like I would say, where do I go more often than any place right now? It's the Pho Bach on Rainier over by Cloverdale. Like I love Asian food. So like, I'm just like, oh, okay, let me try this or let me try that. So I don't know.
What is your attraction to Asian food? I know I like Asian food because I don't really eat dairy.
I think that it just started with my dad. Like when we first moved here, like we have farmers markets in Kansas City, but not like the markets here. And we came and down in downtown Renton, there was this like just Asian market and just had all these vegetables, and we always like ate a lot of vegetables growing up. And so my dad went crazy. He went cuckoo bears and he just started buying stuff that we didn't know. We ate so many bamboo shoots. I just started eating bamboo shoots again. Oh my good Lord, man. But just all kind of crazy things that we didn't know. They were crazy because we just didn't know. Right. And then I just loved it.
So what would be your advice for young Black women today trying to get into the culinary business or a business in general?
I think the one of the bigger things that I always encourage people to do is ask questions. I love it when people call me and say, hey, I'm new to this, or I'm interested in taking this different direction. What do you think? Do you have a moment? And I'm always willing to do it just because I know how important it is. I think definitely building a network, because this industry is brutal for everybody. Physically, you know, we have a high rate of divorce, high rates of alcoholism and drug addiction. People that can't make it in other industries are always looking to the food industry as a backup. So it's an interesting space to be in, a lot of crazy folks. And you need to know what your level of crazy is, and you need to build a community around it so that you can be able to sustain yourself. That's just huge, and never stop learning.
That was Elena Caldwell with the Hella Black, Hella Seattle podcast, talking with local chef Christy Brown. Christy's own cooking community includes her son, and together they have a line of local food products called That Brown Girl Cooks, including Christy's infamous black-eyed pea hummus. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're hungry. This show is all about food and the people whose lives revolve around food in some way. If you owned a coffee shop, you'd probably want to get the word out about when it's open, where it's located. You want to draw people in, right? Well, this is not the case for a small local business in downtown Bellingham, Washington. In fact, this place is really a social experiment in disguise. Sound Effect contributor Alex Ashley brings us this story.
You could stare at this place for several minutes and still not see it.
Onyx, a tiny coffee shop that sits along a side street in downtown Bellingham, Washington, seems to barely exist. There's no drive-thru, no parking, no easily visible sign. It's not easy to find. The only hint that it's even there is a small sandwich board in front of the door. And it's just as bare bones inside.
So we don't have any milk or cream or sugar. We don't have anything at all other than black coffee.
That's Edwin Martinez, the owner of Onyx Coffee. He says the simplicity of the place, totally by design.
The space is kind of a mad scientist lab that has evolved to being just a bar that's open one day a week for experimenting and learning more about human behavior with coffee. So it's kind of an incubator. I had a hypothesis that I didn't share with a lot of people because anyone I shared it with, they thought it was completely crazy.
Martinez actually gave a TED talk on his experiment a few years ago in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
So, what I did is I had a plan. It's really a calculated experiment, and it's still open today, by the way. If you ever come through Bellingham, you can check it out. One person runs it, and we have nothing but coffee. The seating is not comfortable. There's no Wi-Fi. It's hard to find. There's no sign. There's no sugar. There's no cream. It's fantastic. So if
we open a place that intentionally does not have any of the values that people listed when I surveyed, the answers aren't what most people would think.
I'd say it's a good place to like meet up with people and like hang out. I feel like it's a good social environment.
I usually go there to study with friends or just kind of like relax and just draw and have time to myself. The coffee's good.
The coffee is like frosting on the cake.
it's okay.
So if you love coffee, if you really want to engage, you are just in seventh heaven. But if you aren't there for the coffee, this is the most disappointing coffee house in America. And I love it. And my philosophy is often to pursue something that you love and put it out there. But does that mean it's going to be a good business?
And that's something I think. How's business doing?
Terrible.
So the brick and mortar shop, which Martinez opened in 2011, isn't his bread and butter. He supports himself mostly by growing and importing coffee, which he then sells to roasters. The coffee comes straight from his family's farm in the mountains of northwest Guatemala.
Huehuetenango.
It's been in the family since his grandfather, a pastor, bought the plot of land in the 1950s.
And his interest was not as much specifically coffee, but it happens to be that that's what was produced in that part of the country. And even to this day, over 90% of the agriculture in northwest Guatemala is coffee. And it's the most coffee-dense region in all of Guatemala. So it wasn't something that he chose, but it checked that box for farmland, and he loved it. And now it's in our veins.
If he hadn't bought that land, you may not be doing what you do now.
Yeah, absolutely not. It could have been corn or sugar, and it would be totally. I can't imagine what that would look like. What I'm doing is simply taking what that farm produces and going through all the work of processing it, exporting it, and then importing it, selling it.
And he's learned something. In a coffee-centric culture, in a country that imports $4 billion of coffee every year and consumes 400 million cups a day,
the things that drive people to coffee are anything but the coffee.
He thinks he also knows why people view coffee the way they do in the Pacific Northwest. There's so much. There's coffee literally everywhere.
I think it's a very saturated coffee culture. The bottom of the bar is higher here, I think, than most parts of the country. However, the top of the bar is, I think, also lower than most parts of the country. And the reason for that is when I think under the shadow of Starbucks, just having specialty coffee evolve with really espresso and Italian culture and espresso-based beverages, we had a disproportionate growth in the Pacific Northwest of espresso-based beverages in places that had them. We quickly became the experts, but we've really failed to evolve because we're saturated with connoisseurs.
If Martinez has proved anything with Onyx Coffee, it's that the Pacific Northwest, places like Seattle and Bellingham, have too many options. You could practically throw a dart and hit a coffee shop. And those shops are now offering so much more than coffee that it's become one of the last reasons people go there in the first place. Even so, Martinez is busier than ever in the coffee business. Onyx is still open. The great experiment is still running. So if you can find it, you can still get a cup of really, really good coffee.
That story was from sound effect contributor Alex Ashley. Welcome back to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we are hungry. We're revisiting stories about food and about people whose lives are shaped by feeding others. In this next story, we're going to introduce you to Trevis Gleason. In the late 90s, he was a star chef in Seattle. And then in 2001, when he was just at the peak of his culinary career, he got some really devastating news. Gleason was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Gleason ended up moving to Ireland, and it was there, he says, that he found some clarity. He tells the story of it in his book, Chef Interrupted, and he sat down to talk with 88.5's Dick Stein. They begin their conversation with a reading from the book.
Living with multiple sclerosis, MS, has made me live my life in fast forward. But first, there was an adjustment period. The events I'm about to recount transpired nearly 5 years after my diagnosis, 5 years during which more adjustment was required than I'd prefer to recall. In that time, the career with which I identified myself was ripped away. A strong marriage crumbled, and subsequent relationships faltered as I stumbled my way through the ruins of my former life. I came to realize that MS is not a death sentence, it's a life sentence. And while anyone could step into the street and be hit by a bus, people living with MS have seen the bus. We've been hit by the bus, and we know that for the rest of our lives, we will walk along the bus route with our backs to traffic.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's actually going on with MS. In the book, you kind of describe it as the body eating the insulation off of its own wires.
If you think about it, your brain is a telephone, and every part of your body, organs, muscles, nerves, everything is another telephone. And the cables that we see along the street carrying the signals, they're insulated by a thick rubber coating that insulates the copper, which actually transmits the signal. In my body, in our brains and central nervous system, that insulation is called myelin. In multiple sclerosis, the body's immune system eats away at that myelin, that rubber coating. So those copper wires, if you will, start to corrode, they rust, they scar. Multiple sclerosis means many scars in Greek. So if you think about what a phone conversation would sound like, one phone to another, if it's going through one of these areas of corrosion, it might be staticky, and that might be pins and needles or a sizzling pain that someone feels with MS. Sometimes you would hear every other word, and so that might be a tremor kind of thing that's coming from the body. So the bad part is sometimes the connection is just lost. And if it's lost, numbness occurs, lack of control. When a connection is severed, a lot of times that's permanent.
Well, all of this ended your career as a chef and a consultant, and as you said, ended your marriage. What were the issues that caused your marriage to end?
After years of therapy, I figured out that it had to do with a worthiness kind of thing. I believed that persona of the chef that everyone else had created around me, and I tried to live out to that, you know, that ballooned exterior. And when MS popped a pin in that, the whole thing deflated, and I flailed around, literally and figuratively, to figure out my way out. And a lot of things, a lot of people were damaged in that process, but you know, once I did make it out, I did have a kernel of who Trevis Gleason still was. And that was the time that I could start to rebuild this new life.
Well, what I'm taking from the book is that the beginning of the new life was in Ireland.
I went there to fulfill a very old desire, dream, and started to realize that that there was something new out there. It was restorative to me. I guess there, more than anything else, I learned the importance and the value of laughing at my own self. You know, the roads in Ireland ended up being a metaphor for how I was learning to live my life with MS. It has to do with looking far enough ahead that I could meet oncoming traffic at a time and a place of purpose and intent. Because if you're looking just at the next curve, you're not being responsible to everybody that's in the car. You're not seeing what might happen. But if you look too far down the road, then you miss all the beauty that's all around you. So I had to figure out a way to look far enough ahead to answer two or three of those, well, what ifs with, well, then I woulds. And that metaphor really kind of served me through my time in Ireland and then afterwards. It was looking far enough ahead to be responsible, but not looking so far ahead that I miss the joys of life.
Well, we've talked a little bit about what you've lost when all of this came down upon you. What have you found?
Wow, that is a really good question. I think I've found an inner peace, and as I say in the book, I came to the realization that retirement for me was not going to find me 70 years old in a canoe fishing in a pond in Vermont. If I was going to experience any of those things that I hoped to do at some point, then I was going to have to figure out a way to make them happen. No, they haven't happened in the way I thought. They haven't happened in the way I dreamed, but I've made some of them happen. So that's, I think, what I've taken from this. And I say this emphatically to people, and this is my own little bailiwick, is that if anyone lives better or feels more connected with something after a diagnosis and after coming through the dark periods that can cause, it's because the good was already in them. And they reached down into a really dark, nasty, smelly, filthy place of disease. And they found a kernel of goodness that was in them. And they dragged it out and dusted it off and took that and grew with it. It was already there. And I like to say, MS didn't teach me anything, but I've been a good student of what was there to learn.
That was former Seattle chef Trevis Gleason talking with 88.5's Dick Stein. Trevis's book is called Chef Interrupted. Listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're telling stories about food. When you think of iconic Seattle foods, you might think of salmon or Dick's Burgers or a hot bowl of pho. But Seattle has another culinary tradition that tends to fly under the radar. It is the Seattle-style hot dog. We wanted to know where it came from. So Sound Effect contributor Matthew Strybe went out in search of its origin.
I am getting fat, and if I have anything to blame for it, it's the Seattle dog. I eat two or three a week. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar, a Seattle dog could be any kind of hot dog, but it's distinguished by a heap of grilled onions and a smear of melting cream cheese. Seattle dogs are very popular late at night when intoxicated diners hit up street vendors. I went out to Capitol Hill at 2 a.m., where patrons told me cream cheese makes hot dogs unforgettable.
It just gives it just a little extra that is something you can't get anywhere else.
The first one's kind of weird. Second one's, like, pretty decent. Third one, you're just like, I'm addicted.
Cream cheese, like, inserted into the hot
dog. No,
like,
I don't think it sounds kind of gross, but it's really not gross.
Especially when you get the hot links with the cream cheese.
Yeah, mix it all together.
Perfect.
Perfect.
But why is a hot dog covered in cream cheese called a Seattle dog? Where would this even come from?
It's a new phenomenon. It became the Seattle-style hot dog when some Moroccan dude started selling them on the hill.
Trailer somewhere in Spokane.
Someone from Philadelphia? I don't know. Probably.
Now, I'm from Pennsylvania, and I can tell you this. No one in Philadelphia puts cream cheese on a hot dog. This is a Seattle thing. And from the get-go, I was pretty sure the late-night diners on Capitol Hill were all wrong about where it came from. So I decided to try and find the origin, and I asked vendors where I should go. They sent me down to Safeco Field to see Al Griffin of Al's Gourmet Sausage. Al's been selling hot dogs for 21 years. He was the first to sell them at the stadium, covertly tucking his stand inside someone's garage before the city allowed street vending in 2002.
Had a guy come out 2:30 in the morning, get his sausage, and kid you not, he went into his pocket and pulled out a packet of cream cheese. And I said, wow, this cream cheese is pretty serious, man. And ever since then, I made sure I kept it at the stand.
So Al didn't invent the idea, but he was the one who put grilled onions on it. So who put the cream cheese on it?
If I had to give the credit, because I was back there then, yeah, I think the guy that used to sell the bagels pretty much was doing the bagel thing at night, and I think it kind of caught from there.
A bagel guy? Cream cheese and bagels make sense, but who eats a hot dog on a bagel? I mean, a hot dog is long and a bagel is round. It doesn't work. And who is this bagel guy? All clues pointed to a man named Hadley Long, so I headed out to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho to meet him. I pulled up to a little yellow house on a corner, the home of the bagel guy. He expected me and had pulled out memorabilia from decades ago in Pioneer Square. Strewn across his yard and in his house, there was everything. There were banners, there were t-shirts that said Hadley the Bagel Man, and there were hundreds of Polaroids of Hadley with smiling people holding pork products. He was a different Hadley then, with sideburns, bushy hair, and smizing Windex blue eyes as he mans his wooden cart. He still has that cart, and was excited to stand behind it again.
Pretend I'm buying a spicy with hot dog with cream cheese.
Number one seller.
You're handing it to me. What do you say to me?
I say to you, hold on to it. Two hands.
Why do I need to hold on to it?
Because it's going to just fly right out of there. It's going to jump out of there. That cream cheese is slippery.
Being a bagel vendor in Seattle was a lifelong dream for Hadley. He grew up in Athens, Ohio, where as a teenager in the 70s, he would frequent the cart of Louie the Bagel Man. Bagels back then were hip, popular, and Louie was always the center of attention.
So I saw him doing it, and I said, well, I want to be the bagel man, but I'll go to another college town. They were so unique, you know, and I wouldn't necessarily say cutting edge, but, you know, they were new.
I know it may sound weird to hear bagels called cutting edge, but until recently, they kind of were. Bagels have been a Jewish staple for centuries, but in the 1960s, Americans were so unfamiliar with them that the New York Times had to explain what they were. They called a bagel, quote, an unsweetened donut with rigor mortis. It was only in the 1970s that bagels started to be sold across the country, so in Ohio, they were new. And it was in the late 1980s that bagels began to be so popular that they would eclipse donut sales. And this peak of popularity was when Hadley moved to Seattle to open up his very own bagel shop. I know, you thought this was a story about a hot dog, and it is. Hadley was a vegetarian, and so were all of his products. But Hadley's customers wanted meat. And so in 1988, he put a hot dog on a bagel.
I did not want to be a hot dog vendor for business. It was just something I had to do. So my compromise was, well, I'll just put it on my bagel stick instead of the round bagel, the Bialy stick, and then I'd put cream cheese on there. So I wouldn't be selling, you know, in my mind, I wouldn't be selling out, you know.
But this wasn't the Seattle dog that we know today. When Hadley described his Seattle dog, he talked about it being a hearty meal with poppy seeds and dehydrated onions that gave it subtle complexity. He was proud of it, and it was popular. Hadley told me the grunge scene was instrumental in its growth. His cart was right next to the clubs where bands like Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and Alice in Chains got their start. and concertgoers would come to see Hadley after their shows. Then, other vendors started copying him, and the Seattle Dog, as we know it today, was born.
I had one-on-one relationship with, like, every customer. You know, it wasn't just a transaction, you know, it wasn't just a sale. I got to be friends with all these people. I actually had good camaraderie and loved ones. And I was the only one out there, which is another reason I left, you know. I saw me being copied all over town and such.
A lot of the people who have copied you have signs that say, like, they're the home of the Seattle Dog or the original Seattle Dog. How does it feel when you hear or see of other people claiming credit for it?
Well, more power to them, but, you know, they know they're false, you know. I don't want to say they're liars, but let's just say, you know, it's just they know they're not true. Let's put it that way. There was only one, and I was the original.
Hadley Long left Seattle in 2004, but his legacy remains, if only on my waistline.
Whether or not you are remembered for it, you are, I guess, a part of Seattle now, because the Seattle Dog has become a thing. It is a thing.
Foodie history, as one of my friends said. Had, you are Seattle foodie history.
That story from sound effect contributor Matthew Scribe. Is going to do it for this week's show. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad, Allie Ferguson, and Kyle Norris. We get help this week from Ed Ronco, Ariel Van Cleve, Elena Caldwell, Alex Ashley, Dick Stein, Matthew Stribe, and Arwin Nix. We get web help from Simone Alisea, Parker Miles Blom helps with photos and videos, Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find our podcast on iTunes, where you can take a minute to rate and review the show. That would actually be a really big help. And you can also find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. And if you have a story that you would like to share, or if you'd like to give us some feedback, send an email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We will be back next week, same time, same place, when our theme is Under the Influence.